Good Monday evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 30th, 2020, on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on tonight's show, how Arkansas PBS is helping students learn while the school buildings are closed, how Benton County is preparing for a runoff election during unusual times, and an update from our colleagues on the other side of the state after a tornado hit Jonesboro this weekend. Tomorrow on Morning Edition on 91.3, Pakistanis pride themselves on their volunteer culture. And as the coronavirus shuts down commerce there, some citizens are springing into action to help those who are worse off. But in some parts of the country, delivering food and supplies can be extra risky. How the pandemic is posing challenges Pakistanis have never faced before. Plus the day's news on Morning Edition from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF tomorrow. And Antoinette Grajeda gives us the latest news information from our part of the world at 5:30 and 7:30 tomorrow morning. During his daily briefing on the state response to the coronavirus pandemic, Governor Asa Hutchinson this afternoon announced the allocation of additional funding to purchase more personal protective equipment for the doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals working on the front lines of the outbreak. The state had previously allocated $30 million, but the governor says it's clear that won't be enough to last through the crisis.
So based upon what the legislature did in creating the COVID-19 Rainy Day Fund, I am announcing the approval of $45 million in additional funds to go toward purchase of the personal protective equipment, in addition, purchase of ventilators as they become available in the marketplace. We have to allocate those funds in advance in order to be able to get in the supply chain. And we're looking not just what we need tomorrow in 30 days, but we're having to look at what we need 60 days down the road.
Governor Hutchinson says he was on a call this morning with President Trump, Vice President Pence, and other governors. Since they're focusing on COVID-19 hotspots like New York City, California, and New Orleans, states like Arkansas are having a hard time getting into the PPE and ventilator supply chains to get what they need.
And so we're having to compete on a very difficult marketplace. I spoke with one supplier today and said his demand is 64% more than his capacity to produce. And that's a seller's market. They dictate the price, they dictate the terms to a certain extent. So we're having to work in that environment, and we're doing it by the state being engaged in larger purchases so that we can compete with the others that are around the country and internationally looking at the acquisition of same thing we're trying to acquire.
The governor today also announced that under the Federal CARES Act passed last week, states will get funding to get them through the coronavirus crisis. The governor says he believes Arkansas will see about $1.25 billion. That money should start coming in soon, but he says it has to be allocated to costs related to the pandemic before the end of the year.
So today I've signed an executive order setting up a 15-member steering committee made up of my administration and six members of the General Assembly in order to guide and shape and make recommendations on the use of the federal money as they come in.
Also this afternoon, Arkansas Secretary of Health Nate Smith announced an additional death related to COVID-19, bringing the Arkansas total to 7. He says it's also the first death stemming from a case found in several nursing homes. At last check, there were 473 cases of coronavirus in the state, with 62 hospitalizations, which is 19 higher than the number reported yesterday. 21 of those patients are on ventilators. And efforts to flatten the curve mean Fayetteville Farmers Market will continue to be in the winter space at Evelyn Hills Shopping Center on College Avenue in the parking lot there. From 7 to 8 Saturday mornings, seniors will be able to shop, and the general public can shop from 8 to 1 on Saturdays. Vendors will be set up outside with ample spacing to accommodate social distancing, along with hand wash stations set up at entrances. The vendors will be limited to farm products and items listed as essential. Customers are asked to be aware of social distancing at all times and allow producers to package all products, eliminating any contact from customers touching products. Also, vendors are putting into effect ways alternative options can be used for transacting, with a preference for credit or debit transactions. This is Ozarks at Large. COVID-19 is affecting almost everybody, from health to lifestyle to the ability to pay for necessities. As classes resume today at the University of Arkansas after spring break, resuming online, there are students who are in need. The University of Arkansas has four student emergency funds. The primary fund, U of A Cares, helps students with unexpected needs that arise from situations beyond the student's control. There is also the Veterans Resource and Information Center Emergency Fund to aid students who have been or currently are serving in the military. And two funds for graduate students and international students, providing a stopgap for students struggling with unforeseen emergencies. Friday morning, we talked with Dean Kim Needy, Dean of the Graduate School in International Education at the U of A, about those latter two funds.
One of the funds is the International Education Catastrophic Fund, and the other is the Needy Family Graduate Student Emergency Fund. And these funds were set up about 3 years ago, but over the last month or so, we recognized that there was this greater and greater need, and we could see a tidal wave coming towards us with additional needs. And so that's where this idea came up to really begin to promote these funds. They have initially kind of very modest amounts that we can give out, but the urgency then to bring greater awareness so that we could maybe get more support for these funds because we knew there would be more demand. And so we're focusing on getting the word out for those who may need support, as well as those who may be able to provide support.
There are challenges that students on any campus face, of course, but I think there are some unique ones that both unique to graduate students and unique to international students, and of course, some students fall into both of those categories. What are some of the unique challenges that they face?
Okay, let me begin just with graduate students in general, and they may be domestic or they may be international, but many of our full-time graduate students are also trying to support a family. So they may have a partner, they may have children, they are on a graduate assistantship, which by all means is very modest, and it becomes just a challenge without any kind of problems for them to manage this. So when something like a pandemic comes in, this presents unique challenges to them. Similarly, for our international students, they have a lot more restrictions with respect to travel, with respect to work. So international students are not permitted to work off campus. So they may have additional part-time jobs to support their living expenses in order to supplement a graduate assistantship if they're a graduate student. But what has happened here recently is that, as you know, a lot of the jobs have gone away as businesses and campus has closed. And so for graduate students who are able to work off campus, they may have lost jobs. For international students who may have worked on campus, they may have lost jobs. In addition, then, there are added expenses as people are taking care of family members that maybe were in school and now are not in school and are home, and they have responsibility for helping their children, let's say, continue with their education in a K through 12 setting, as an example.
And, I mean, we're all going through something most of us have never gone through before, and that can be tough when you see a global crisis and you're away from home. For many undergraduate students, and not to minimize this, you might be miles or a few counties or maybe a state away. For some graduate and international students, you're really far away from home and a network that you might rely on otherwise, and that's got to be tough.
It is very tough. There is a huge feeling of isolation, and I pride ourselves at the University of Arkansas of having a really excellent support system for our students, but that doesn't replace the support system that these students have at home, wherever that may be across the globe, with their family and their friends. And the isolation has affected, as you said, every one of us. I mean, all of us are encouraged to stay at home or stay close to home. So even the idea of traveling back home, you know, to Dallas, Texas, or something like that, is really, in a sense, discouraged. But certainly for these students who live in Europe or Asia, et cetera, they can't go home. And this feeling of not being able to, as opposed to, you know, just not wanting to, is a really, really added stress. And so students do feel isolated. They can't do the normal things that they do. So there's a little bit of boredom in that sense that also sets in. And so we're also cognizant and trying to come up with resources to keep students not only physically well and healthy with the pandemic, but also mentally healthy and well with respect to all these added stressors that are on top of them.
So how do these emergency funds work? How can people make a donation? How can a student make a request?
Okay, so we have a simple process, really, for the students. And so the students can go to our website, and they can make a request for the funding. And it's pretty easy. We don't ask, really, for a lot of information. And then we have a committee that looks at these very rapidly, because they are emergencies. We have to respond quickly. Responding in a month isn't quick enough. You know, sometimes we need to respond in days. And so we have a committee that is assessing these and making decisions. And they're looking at those based on, you know, kind of that need that is described, and also looking at the availability of funds that we have. So, you know, we're making awards for, in this case, you know, the pandemic, but students also have challenges personally with maybe unforeseen healthcare costs. So the funds do not cover what I would call expenses a student should expect to pay. So a student should expect to have to pay tuition. They should expect to pay some kind of housing costs, et cetera. But we're talking about unusual, unexpected expenses. And so when they occur, we're trying to assess those and really make the case for it. As far as those who are able to give, I'll just say no donation is really too small. And we've had people give $10. We've had people give thousands of dollars, and everywhere really in between. And again, the university has the website set up where it's easy to give to these couple of two funds. There are also other funds for the UA CARES system. The law school has a fund, et cetera, to direct money in those ways as well.
Finally, I imagine a situation like this, I mean, there is no way you can absolutely prepare for how a pandemic will affect students or university campus. So you can't be have a playbook for that. But I do imagine, as your career has gone on, everything has, to some degree, helped you prepare for something like this.
Well, I'll just say this. I mean, it's quite shocking, I guess, when you meet students one-on-one. So in one sense, you know, we're managing kind of the big, you know, the graduate school, international students. But I'll tell you, on a day-to-day basis, when we sit down, when we meet these students, when we hear their stories, when we hear their challenges, when we hear how much really they're trying to do on their own, and they do on their own, but sometimes they just get down to, you know, their last wits. They're not sure how to fix something. And what's inspired me personally and helped to form my opinion on these are those personal stories of students overcoming these challenges. And I will just say this, our community and our campus, our faculty and staff are just so generous. And I know I have many stories, even before these funds existed, of faculty and staff just reaching into their wallets and giving students some money, because sometimes the hurdles are relatively small. You know, it's an unpaid parking ticket the student, you know, can't figure out how they're are going to pay, or, you know, the next meal and they're not going to they can't figure out how they're going to do it, or a doctor's bill the student just isn't sure how they're going to pay. And so as I've worked in this field and just seen these stories, you know, these stories have prepared me because they're individuals. These are other human beings. And I realize I'm personally so fortunate, and I just want to kind of share. And our campus is fortunate. We are the people, fortunately, that through this pandemic are still working, and many are not. So even people who are able are not able now because of these unforeseen circumstances.
Dean Kim Needy, thank you so much for your time. Be well. We appreciate your conversation with us.
Thank you so much.
Kim Needy is Dean of the Graduate School and International Education at the University of Arkansas. We have links to all four emergency funds for students at the U of A at OzarksAtLarge.com. Beginning today, Arkansas PBS is broadcasting programming in response to mandatory school closures due to COVID-19. Arkansas AMI is streamlined curriculum-based programming for the state's pre-K through 8th grade students, created in partnership with the Arkansas Department of Education. Late last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke by phone with Courtney Pledger, Executive Director and CEO of Arkansas PBS, to learn more about this new initiative.
The development of the curriculum is on the Department of Education side. So what we have done, or what they originally did, was identify three bands, grade bands. So the first one is pre-K through second grade. The second one is third through fifth. And the third is sixth through eighth grade. So we went to our vast library of PBS programs and identified programs for each band, sort of in line with particular curriculum needs that ADE had identified. So once we passed those ideas on to specific shows onto ADE, they viewed them and approved them all and got to work on curriculum that was aligned with each one of these programs. The other thing that we decided to do, which has turned out to be terrific, I think, is to personalize this with Arkansas teachers. So five of the Arkansas Teachers of the Year from across the state will be on-camera teachers in segments, in teaching segments that surround the programming and address each specific program.
The programming is scheduled to roll out on Monday. So if I'm a parent at home with my child, what can I expect to see? Is there a certain time that I should tune in, or how will I be able to incorporate this into the homeschooling that I'm doing right now?
The pre-K through second grade band is from 8 to 9:30 a.m. Then grade 3 through 5 is 9:30 to 11. And grade 6 through 8 is 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., roughly. We may run over a little bit, but those are the basic times. And ADE has developed, and actually it's the Division of Elementary and Secondary Education, which is part of the Department of Ed. They have created packets that will be distributed digitally to the different school districts, and each school district will make their decision on how to utilize the AMI. We'll be airing on our main channel, which is a different channel number in six different areas of the state, but that will be on our main channel, and then by no later than 4 p.m., The same content will be available online on our website. So anybody who missed it between 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. can go to the website and watch the same thing streaming in the afternoon and evening.
And you mentioned giving the AMI packets digitally to the schools to distribute. Do you have other digital resources available for parents on your website?
Yes, we do. We have long provided classroom resources through PBS Learning Media, and there are resources available through through Learning Media. The IDEAS, Arkansas IDEAS website, which is our teacher professional development website, offers a resource page with a whole lot of different resources. You can also sign up for a newsletter that goes out daily, Schoolhouse Daily, it's called. And that provides a whole lot of information and suggestions for this time.
And you have created or curated, I guess I should say, content for the next 3 weeks?
We will be announcing the schedule 1 week at a time. Obviously, the first week is locked, and as we're now just about locked on the schedule for the second week. So because of the lack of lead time, that's how we're working, and it's really an all hands on deck effort for us at Arkansas PBS and a lot of people at DESE, the Division of Elementary and Secondary Education. They pivoted to put a lot of their time into this, so it's been a real collaborative effort.
As with most things right now, everything sounds like it's, you know, on a day-by-day basis. So if we do get to the point where perhaps schools are closed for the rest of the school year, will you plan on continuing to work something out so that you can continue providing this type of programming?
We are already discussing that if that possibility occurs. And, of course, we will be there for the long haul, whatever's needed.
What is the benefit of providing this additional programming for parents and their kids right now?
Well, it keeps kids learning, you know. And I know that Department of Ed really is looking to support continuous learning, to really reinforce and maintain kids' skills, and to keep them actively literate, actively community engaged. So it's a resource that, depending on the individual district and their decision, can either be supplementary to what the district is planning to do, or fundamental and really be the heart of what's happening in that district. If people have questions, on the broadcast side, they can reach out to Arkansas PBS at 501-682-2386 during the hours of 8 and 4:30, or they can email info@myarkansaspbs.org. For help with educational instruction, they need to contact our Arkansas PBS education team, same hours, Monday through Friday, 8 to 4:30. The help desk number is 501-682-0317, or email is amihelp@myarkansaspbs.org. The program is called AMI, Alternative Methods of Instruction. And we're really close to our education community. We communicate with our teachers, and we've been hearing from a lot of them on their enthusiasm for this program. By Jacqueline Morton, who's a wonderful 7th and 8th grade science teacher at Cedarville Middle School. She's excited that her science students are going to be able to watch some special episodes of NOVA, and to really have them aligned to the Arkansas curriculum standards is terrific. She'll be able to teach her students to think critically about Earth's place in relation to the solar system. And then people like Chris Harmon, who teaches math at Lakeside Junior High in Springdale, he's excited his kids will be able to connect with various science and social studies programs, and that they can continue to learn how to apply math skills in the real world. And he's particularly looking forward to, and so are we, an activity hosted on air by our 2020 Arkansas Teacher of the Year, Joel Lookadoo. That will help the students build number sense and fluency in really fun math games.
Well, I know it's a lot of work, but it's very much in line with PBS's mission, so it makes sense. And I'm really glad that you guys are able to partner and help out the students.
We've been talking about Mr. Rogers a lot this week. You know, when times are scary, people are nervous, then, you know, he would always tell children, or I guess the child and all of us, he would tell us to look for the helpers. So we've been looking at it that way, that we have the ability to help at this time, and that's what we intend to do.
Well, thank you so much for all your hard work and for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Antoinette.
That was Courtney Pledger, Executive Director and CEO of Arkansas PBS, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda Friday. More information about Arkansas AMI available at myarkansaspbs.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Mockingbird Kitchen, locally owned and operated, offering takeout and curbside delivery Tuesday through Sunday, including weekend brunch. Located in Evelyn Hill Shopping Center, Fayetteville. MockingbirdKitchen.com for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. I am in the Furman Garner Performance Studio. I have measured. Lee Wood, our general manager, is in here with me. She's 11 and a half feet away in our largest square footage studio in the building.
That was very smart. Thank you, Kyle.
All right. We are in a fundraiser week.
We are. A fundraiser week unlike any that that I've been a part of. We are airing fundraising messages this week to raise money. It's slightly different than how we normally do an on-air fundraiser. We do not have volunteers in the building. We are not taking donations over the phone. We're asking for donations through our online page, supportkuaf.com. We do have a challenge pledge that basically we were gathering challenge pledges in preparation for the fundraiser earlier this year. And what we've decided to do is pool all of those challenge pledges together in one big one, totaling $23,000. So all gifts this week, up to $23,000 will be matched dollar for dollar, thanks to all of those generous donors. In fact, I'd like to thank some of them. Barbara Taylor, Ben and Amber Pinter, Bob and Patty Beesom, Bruce and Ann Applegate, David and Deb Malone, and Dick and Caroline Smith. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Just a portion of donors who've put up their own money to encourage our listeners to give. They'll match your donation dollar for dollar. And I'm happy to say that we have been raising money over the weekend, and we're almost $10,000 in.
That's great.
For our overall total, which is great. And so when we reach $23,000, we'll be able to put that challenge money back in. That's going to get us really close to our overall goal, which is $50,000.
Which is half of what we had budgeted to raise back before the pandemic. What happens, I'm going to think optimistically here, what happens if we hit the halfway, or we hit the new goal, which is half of the original goal, Wednesday, Thursday, or early Friday?
Well, that would be incredible if that happened. And if it does, I think we're going to keep fundraising. I mean, like you said, we did adjust our goal to 50% of what we originally needed to raise. And if we are able to raise more than that, that's only going to help us, in our budget.
Because our cost did not get cut in half.
No, that has not happened.
All right. It's really interesting. This is the first time you and I have seen each other in person in quite a while. You have been working from home. People on Ozarks at Large are filing stories and sending them by Dropbox. They're putting them together in closets and living rooms all over Northwest Arkansas.
Yes, absolutely. And as we're raising money, as it's coming through our website, we have Sherry Ottaviano, our membership director, is doing that work from her home and is processing that money. And Rhonda Dillard, our underwriting director, is working from home, working with our underwriting clients. So we are kind of spread out, not working in the office. But I would say, especially your news team is working harder and working longer hours. The news cycle is so fast, and we have so much to cover and so many personal stories to tell about how this pandemic is affecting the citizens of our listening area that I'm really impressed. We've changed the way we've worked, but we're still doing vitally important work.
And we can hear from you online at supportkuaf.com.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks, Lee. This is Ozarks at Large. It's Election Day in Benton County tomorrow. Votes are being cast in primary runoff elections for State House of Representative races in Districts 90 and 91. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with Kim Dennison, election coordinator for Benton County, to learn more about the steps they're taking to prevent the spread of COVID-19 on Election Day.
So we have sanitized all of our equipment before it goes out the door to our polling sites. Once our polling sites open on Tuesday, when voters come in, they will see some of our poll workers, if they wish, will be wearing face masks that I have made for them, as well as using gloves to handle IDs and things with so that they can help prevent the spread of even more germs. Voters will then be getting their own stylist and using that stylist to sign the tablet and taking it with them to the voting machines so that we're not having the same person using the pen to sign in with, as well as touching the voting machines to make their selections. We'll ask them to leave that stylist in a bucket on their way out the door, and we will sanitize those throughout the day to be reused. And then we'll provide hand sanitizer as well for them to use on their way out the door.
Did you say that you made masks?
I did.
Like sewing them from fabric, or how did you do that?
Yes. Yeah. Sewing them with fabric.
Are you a seamstress naturally?
I can make a blanket. My grandmother taught me the basics of sewing when I was younger, and I was glad I had that skill set to get us through this, because I was not having any luck finding any paper masks for my poll workers, and I wanted them to have some sort of protection because I was having a hard time getting poll workers anyways. And so this was just one of my steps in helping them feel protected while they were out at the polling sites.
Poll workers are generally older, retired citizens, correct?
They are. Most of them are. I do have a few of, I guess, what you'd call the younger generation, between the ages of 30 and 50. And so I have really reached out to that age group to see if they would be willing to step in for this election so that we could keep the older people safe at their homes rather than exposing them to anything that may be floating around.
There are 6 voting centers throughout the county, if I have that right. How many poll workers do you have for all of that?
There will be 4 at each location all day long. Some of them may be working half days, some of them may be working full days, but there will be 4 people there all day long.
Now, there's been an emphasis on social distancing during this whole thing, but historically, runoffs have a low turnout. Is that correct?
They normally do, but we have actually seen a very much higher turnout, even during early voting, because the county clerk is still holding early voting with the county offices being closed. We've seen a much higher turnout than we normally do during early voting for runoff elections as well.
Have you been surprised by that, especially considering there's a pandemic on top of just being a primary with generally low turnout?
I really have. And we have sent out over 1,100 absentee ballots on top of that, which is a very large number of absentee ballots to send out. For the primary, we only did a little over 400. And for us to send out 1,100 for a runoff election, I was very surprised by that turnout. So if they all send their absentee ballots back, I'll be very pleased with the turnout that we've had with this election.
And for people that maybe missed who is in the runoff just because of the busy news cycle over the past couple of weeks, can you remind us who is running?
So we have State Representative District 90, which is Jana De La Rosa and Kendon Underwood. And then we have State Representative District 91 with Scott Richardson and Delia Hack.
And can you explain to our listeners why there's a runoff for these elections? What happened and why are we voting again?
There were 3 candidates in each one of those elections for the primary election, and none of them received 50% of the vote. And so, therefore, there has to be a runoff between the top 2 candidates.
So election day is Tuesday, and when will the results be certified?
We have 10 days after the election to certify the results, and so that will happen April the 10th at 1 o'clock.
Given the uncertainty and the interesting couple of weeks that we've had that have added to, you know, the stress of that already exists with an election, how are you feeling, or how do you think things are going?
I can honestly say my staff and myself are exhausted, and we just keep moving right along, because whether we have a turnout of 5 people or 500 people, we have to prepare for a full turnout of all the voters that are registered.
Are there any challenges that maybe we haven't thought of that you've been facing in this current climate?
Actually, we have discovered the issue with people that have requested an absentee ballot, deciding not to fill out the absentee ballot and returning it, and then showing up to early vote, or come election day, they may decide to show up at the polls and decide to vote there rather than returning their absentee ballot. Well, that is going to require them to vote provisionally, because they've already received the absentee ballot, and that will have to be verified that they didn't return the absentee ballot back to the clerk's office. So that has been a struggle that we have already seen going into early voting, with having to do provisional ballots for those that just decided not to vote their absentee ballot because they were afraid it wouldn't get back in time.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your hard work, and I hope you get some rest once it's all over.
Thank you.
That was Kim Dennison, election coordinator for Benton County, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda late last week. Polls will be open tomorrow from 7:30 to 7:30. Votes can be cast at Lakeview Baptist Church in Cave Springs, Lowell First Baptist Church, the Benton County Fairgrounds, Reach Church in Centerton, First Baptist Church of Gentry, and the Siloam Springs Community Building. More information is available at vote.bentoncountyar.gov. Arkansas Governor Hutchinson spent part of yesterday surveying destruction left by a tornado that hit Jonesboro this weekend. Brandon Tabor with our partner station KASU in Jonesboro has more.
Hutchinson told reporters that he felt the damage caused by the EF3 tornado combined with the coronavirus pandemic qualifies Jonesboro to be declared a state disaster.
I have not seen this level of devastation in a tornado since I have been governor. Now, we've had other loss of life, but this, in terms of the breadth of destruction and the comprehensiveness of the tornado path, this has been the largest that I've seen and the most devastating.
Hutchinson said he's working with Arkansas's congressional delegation to get a federal disaster declaration. It would allow affected people and businesses to apply for federal assistance. Hutchinson said small businesses can already get some federal funding through the CARE Act recently passed by Congress for assistance during the pandemic. In Jonesboro, I'm Brandon Tabor.
This is Ozarks at Large. At the beginning of this month, before the coronavirus outbreak arrived in Arkansas, shuttering music venues large and small, the Northwest Arkansas Council released the results of a study that examined the economic impact of the region's music industry. The study was conducted by Sound Diplomacy, a global consulting firm which spent 15 months in 2018 and 2019 analyzing Northwest Arkansas's music ecosystem. We know musicians across the region and country have had to cancel shows and tours as a result of the pandemic. We thought this story was a good reminder of the impact these artists have on our communities. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Allison Esposito, the executive director of a regional art service organization created last year, about Sound Diplomacy's research and their recommendations for elevating Northwest Arkansas's talent.
So what did they find when they came here?
You know, I think there's two ways to answer this question. The first is to say, what does our music ecosystem look like? And what it looks like is a ton of assets dispersed across all of our cities and towns that in many instances, you know, just have not potentially collaborated as much as they could or come together as much as they could, but a lot of really incredible assets and strength and humans. There's a critical mass of super talented musicians, a really visible roots and folk scene that is, you know, nationally known. But there is also this layer of other wonderful genres that are sort of less visible here. And certainly when folks outside of Arkansas are thinking about what's happening in Arkansas, they're not aware of, like hip hop and et cetera and so forth, that that are absolutely robustly happening and are here as well. Sound Diplomacy found, you know, a ton of activity happening to the tune of $389 million of economic development a year coming out of this sector. And a lot of that is coming from shows coming into the marketplace and a lot of our fantastic and well-known venues, as well as 4,000 jobs approximately per year through this industry. So a lot of economy coming from the music industry here. And it's also, you know, the workforce that we're talking about here is much broader than the musicians themselves. It's all of the backstage, the tech, the creative industries in general, which make up a large part of that number. And actually, in comparing those numbers with some of the other research that's been done in the region around the economic sort of footprint of the arts and culture here, the thing to note is that music, you know, falls on both sides of nonprofit and for-profit. And so that's what accounts for that number being kind of smashingly large.
So you touched on it a little bit. What is the region doing right in terms of the music industry sector as it exists right now?
Yeah, tons of stuff. There's so many wonderful people here. You know, I think, again, we have this critical mass of musicians. The university has a very interesting program that they are augmenting right now to, you know, include more of a business practice, business side of the music industry piece, which is very exciting. There are historic venues like George's and newer festivals that are having tons of success, like the Roots Festival. There's obviously the new Momentary and the Walton Arts Center, all of which are sort of an amp, all of which are bringing folks through. I think there's also been some really good grassroots effort to support local talent that has been going on already. Shindig, Music, House of Songs, City Sessions in Bentonville, all of those are really solid. Eddie Vega and the Springdale Civic Center is a super impressive Spanish language venue that, you know, I'm super excited to partner with more. The Station in Springdale and sort of a robust house show hip hop scene of primarily Latinx youth in Springdale is booming and is like happening every weekend. If only I were just a few years younger, I'd show up all the time. So there's a ton going on, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
And so what are the challenges?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. I think certainly it's an unorganized space. And so providing organization and, you know, capital O, and really identifying whose role it is to do what is a huge challenge and a huge opportunity. And also, I've spent the last 6 months really getting to know the music scene here and, you know, trying to bring people together. And it is amazing how quickly folks gel once they're sitting at the same table and realizing that they're doing the same stuff or have the same end goal in mind. So it's going to be, I think, a challenge that will be easily overcome, actually, with some love. A big challenge is actually our need for a music-adjacent workforce. So to the sort of more creative industry field that I was referencing a few moments ago, the tech crew situation with the opening of the Momentary has become more dire. And so there's this large need for skilled backstage folks of all kinds that, you know, we really want to think about. It's not just the musicians and the artistic talent in that way that we want to think about. There's also a need for space. And so from my perspective, I would say there's a need for artist-led spaces for creation and rehearsal and low-cost and low-risk messing around. You know, we have beautiful recording studios here. We have beautiful performance halls. We don't have a lot of small-cap spaces that really allow for this in each of our different cities and markets. And so creating some of those that feel a little bit more DIY, that can allow for more of a scene and more opportunities for collaboration across genre and so forth, I think will be really, really, really great.
Sound Diplomacy came in, did an assessment. They also came out with some recommendations that I believe you are tasked with carrying out some of those. So what are some of the things they recommended? I know one of them is actually creating a space for that messing around that you mentioned, but what else did they recommend the region should do?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the most fundamental need is resourcing and developing our talent. Dollars directly to artists to make, to create. This is an industry in which money is made by touring, helping to forge touring networks, helping to get, you know, very clear creative products coming out of Arkansas that are then sent to other markets in this country is something that I'm really excited about in addition to the space that you just mentioned. I'll also talk a little bit. I'm in the middle of working deeply with our cities. And the city of Rogers has, you know, been first to partner with me and this organization that I'm creating to do some cultural planning work, to engage a robust constituency in Rogers to understand the future of Rogers in 10 years. Where do we want to be from an arts and culture standpoint? And when ArtSpace came in several years ago, they referenced Rogers had just a ton of almost alternative music venues. And then they also have coming online through the design grant they received from the Walton Family Foundation, a new music venue in their Frisco Park. And so Rogers is really excited to think about how it as a city can begin to support music. And I think that's just the beginning of thinking about how our municipalities can be active players and leaders in developing the music scene as well.
Right, because all these cities will take a different approach, I imagine.
That's exactly right. And wanting to differentiate and create unique experiences and unique products and understanding not only who they have there that are the artists that they could work with, but what is that look that they want to put out into the world and how are they bringing different audiences in? And I think music uniquely has, you know, the ability and the opportunity to bring lots of different folks in to experience Rogers in different ways. So
right, or Fayetteville, or yep. Springdale, or, yep. or Bentonville,
all
or Siloam Springs, right?
All of them, yes.
So how, I know this is very early stages, and you guys just got the study, but how do you make these things happen?
Oh, yes. I mean, the first step is to hire a pretty amazing team. And so, you know, we will be staffing up over the coming months to bring some leadership and a central voice to this work. And those folks will be, you know, coordinating, listening, learning. Again, there is an incredible amount of talent and activity here. It's not about replacing any of that. It's just about providing platforms to elevate. And so that's what that staff and team will primarily do. It'll be a collaborative group of folks working with what we already have. You know, again, cultural planning will be happening, so we'll be activating cities, we'll be activating stages, we'll be activating places. We are planning to try and test over the coming year pop-up music spaces to actually, like, on the ground, understand, what does this look like? Where does this need to be? Who's coming? What do audiences want? What do the artists need? What will make those the most vibrant that they possibly can be? And I would just say investing in artists in general, it looks like grant dollars, mentorship, networking with relationships around the country, as I said before, touring pathways, et cetera, et cetera. So I think those are the early moves we're going to make.
And how does diversity play into what you're planning to do? Because we do have, and you mentioned a little bit of that, we have a big Latinx community that's doing stuff in Springdale. And there's, I'm sure, lots of other opportunities to tap into that diversity that we have.
Absolutely. As our, you know, big three businesses in the region are really looking to recruit and retain talent from all over the world that look and feel, you know, all kinds of ways. I think the opportunity to elevate specifically the communities of color that have such culturally rich music already happening within them and connect that to those that are coming in newly to be part of the business community, et cetera, is a huge one.
And I imagine it's a way to just connect everyone else to those communities too.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I think space will play a really big role in that so that those particular genres and forms and expressions are not happening, you know, only, and I think they should continue to certainly happen in house parties and so forth, but are also happening in ways that can help them to develop audience because they are the language of the future.
So if you're a musician or someone working in this industry and you're hearing this, will there be opportunities for people to get involved? I'm sure people are listening and thinking, you know, what does this mean for me? What can I do? to take advantage of this. So will that be coming down the line? Or can people get involved now? Is this something you're looking for down the road?
So this organization is still just me. And so I will say I've gotten to a point where I'm struggling with responsiveness, but that is changing very soon with some other folks coming on, you know, and I think there will be a number of job descriptions that, you know, folks will have an opportunity to apply. We will also build one or several task forces, which will be comprised of folks with different backgrounds and perspectives and, you know, geographic representations across the region to make sure that we're hitting all sides of this thing and getting different voices to the table. And those folks will be helping to make decisions and lead this effort, most definitely. And then I guess I would just say the ethos of the Regional Arts Service Organization in general is that everything we're going to do is going to be open and transparent. So if we are going to have a grant program, it is going to be open for application to the field in general. There will be a panel of people that represents these communities that are adjudicating and evaluating. So yes is the answer. Everyone will be able to participate and find themselves in this work. I'm very hopeful.
What about people who are saying, well, we've just been kind of doing it our way for years?
Yeah.
And what's the benefit of having sort of an organization, capital O organization, that can do this work too? I mean, what's sort of the benefit of maybe having a central location for some of this stuff? Do other cities do it this way or regions?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I've heard from a lot of the music industry folks that I've been talking to locally is just we're already doing a great job. We don't need a new brand. We just need to elevate what's already here. And I guess I just want to continue to say that's exactly what we want to do. It's just about shining a light on what's already happening and giving it more visibility and more resources, honestly. And yes, that is happening in other markets. Music is, a very, in markets where I have recently spent time, folks are investing in music robustly because it's one of the most accessible art forms. It brings different communities together. It can happen in lots of different spaces. It can represent a place very well and then is easily taken out of that place. And so, yes, there is a lot of sort of philanthropic and municipal investment happening in music across the country. And I think it's our opportunity to do that now. I am sort of a discipline agnostic person, and I'm here to support all of the different disciplines that exist, as broad a range as you can possibly imagine from an arts, culture, and creativity point of view. But I would say music is sort of the gateway because people find it to be the most accessible. More people are going to show up, you know, in a field to listen to music than they are to do other arts activities. And so it's a great place to start. And I would say in really healthy ecosystems, of which I myself have been an artist and or working at sort of this level of the field, music has brought dancers together, has brought media together, has brought communities that have really different points of view and, you know, are filled with really different humans into the same space. And so that's the goal here as well.
That was Allison Esposito, the executive director of a regional art service organization that formed last August, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about a study released this month that examined the economic impact of the region's music industry. That conversation recorded at the Carver Center for Public Radio before the pandemic. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Avoca. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Monday evening show included Antoinette Grajeda and Zuzana Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. Our appreciation to Brandon Tabor from KASU in Jonesboro for his reporter and to our general manager, Lee Wood, for her update on our quiet fundraiser. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday evening with us. Back tomorrow at noon with a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. Stay well.